Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today in digest format here on the Courage Handy Hemp System, World Radio for May 2009. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. Publisher is Rich Mawson, W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hemps may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. We'll begin today with the editor's log. Nancy Cott, WZHC, is the editor of World Radio Magazine Online. One of the items in the magazine editor's job description is to select the feature articles each month. It's one of the more interesting tasks because, as the editor of World Radio Online, I have the privilege of reading articles from many different segments of amateur radio. World Radio typically had a monthly de-expedition feature. Only a small percent of hams actually go on a de-expedition. But the stories about the trips include things that most hams are interested in, antennas, portable operating, and experiences shared with fellow ham friends. Articles about contesting are popular, too, for the same reason. Now that we're online, color photographs give the stories the added dimension. That doesn't mean we don't want to read about what you're doing in your own backyard or condo. Quite the opposite. Now that we have established a presence on the Internet and so many people are logging on to download the latest issues that they are clogging up the web server, we want to remind you that we still need your input. Not just about the big ham events in your life, but those little victories too. Remember getting 5 words per minute Morse code under your belt, or how exhilarating it was to finally get that last state needed to complete your work to all states? Has your club held the licensing class where people learn their licenses and have gotten on the air now? Did you try a new antenna configuration that blew the socks off the DX? How about memories of your grandfather warming the room with his vacuum tube rig? Or tell us how you built your first rig from salvage parts. Our people stories are what make World Radio Online a unique publication. Share your stories and pass on the tradition of ham radio. May means hamvention, and although we will miss seeing Armand and Helen Noble at the corner booth in the main arena, there will be a World Radio Online presence at the CQ Communications booth. We are planning a display to showcase our new online format, and we'll have staff available to answer any questions you have about viewing WRO and downloading it. I will be there running between the FISTS, F-I-S-T-S, booth and the CQ Communications booth, so be sure to stop by and say hello. We're still the World Radio family, regardless of the format we are using. I received confirmation from the kind folks at Hamvention that FISTS will occupy our usual spot on the ramp between the main arena and the main cafeteria. We are all looking forward to seeing everyone again and hearing your comments and suggestions. I am embarrassed to say that I have not made a dent in my shack cleanup project. Paul Gates, called KD3JM, sent an email saying that he thought guys had the monopoly of being a pack rat. But I'm showing all the signs of having the pack rat syndrome. Yep, Paul, you hit the nail on the head. If I tossed even half of the stuff I might use someday, it would be half the battle of cleaning the shack, or at least allow me to see my tabletop. In these times of economic challenge, isn't it nice to have a hobby that we don't have to spend a lot of money on to have fun? Has anyone decided to downsize or get back to basics? You know, toss a dipole or two into the trees and dust off those mean green heat kit machines. Maybe mothball the amplifier and run barefoot. If you have, write it up and send it in. We'd love to hear how you're operating on a budget. Don't forget about a WRO Golden Megaphone Club competition. Is your club doing anything special to make Field Day an attraction for the public? Document it. Take lots of photographs and have sign-in sheets, as well as keep notes on what activities you have so it can be written into an article and sent in to us. See you at Hamvention, 7388. Nancy Cott, call WZ8C. You can contact Nancy at her call, WZ8C, at cq-amateur-radio.com or P.O. Box 807, Hadley, Michigan, MI, 48440. Well, it's time to see what's new on the news front. World Radio Online news front. Hall of Science ARC likely to be evicted. New York City's historic Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club appears to have lost its fight to retain a station at its namesake home of 35 years. Despite a cordial meeting and demonstration of amateur radio with the museum's boss, Thomas Tumino, N2YTF, says it appears very unlikely WB2JSM will ever be activated again from the Hall of Science. Quoting, I would say that there is a 90% chance that it is all over at the Hall of Science, Tumino says. There were discussions with the museum about putting the ham radio exhibit on a wheeled cart with remote control of the radios. That's the 10% chance of return Tumino is talking about. You might recall that the museum, located in Flushing Meadows, on the site where the World's Fair was held in the mid-1960s, had asked the club to take down its antennas during a renovation project. It then banned them from putting them back up and began talking about ousting the organization. That sparked an online petition drive that netted some 1,300 signatures. But Tumino, president of the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club, conceded that hasn't changed the museum's mind. The Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club in New York is now looking elsewhere for a home. Quoting, a well-known New York City area ham has kind of taken up our cause to some extent and is helping us with that, Tumino says. So, we don't know yet whether it's a set solution moving to another museum within the New York City limits, but that also looks very promising, and we've already had one meeting with that institution and hope to schedule a second, close quote. While Tumino declined to identify that museum for fear of jeopardizing negotiations, he did say it may be in one of New York's boroughs, but not in Queens. He did say it's an ideal operating location for amateur radio, especially emergency communications. If you would like to sign the petition to help keep the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club at New York City's Hall of Science, please take your web browser to http://tinyurl.com/6LJOST. That was supplied by AR Newsline. National Weather Service, NWS, changes hail reporting criteria. Winds of change are sweeping across Indiana in an effort to streamline the severe thunderstorm warning criteria. Beginning April 1, 2009, reporting stations and sky-worn spotters will begin reporting hail that is 1 inch or larger. Previous reports looked for hail that was pea-size or larger. Quoting, usually damage begins at 1 1/4 size hail rather than warning for hail that is penny size or smaller, according to Dan McCarthy, meteorologist in charge of the Indianapolis National Weather Office. He says parameters for reporting wind speed have also been refined. He says winds reaching 58 miles per hour are now considered a threat. At 60 miles per hour, tree branches break and trees begin to uproot. McCarthy said the whole idea is to provide a more precise service for the public. This change in criteria comes following a 4-year study of hail damage and the issuance of severe thunderstorm warnings in Kansas and the Central Plains. The study found 1-inch hail rather than the historical 3/4-inch threshold as a better indicator for thunderstorm warnings. Illinois, Iowa, and Missouri will join Kansas and Indiana on April 1st to change the hailstone criteria. National Weather Service officials felt the public was becoming desensitized by numerous warnings being issued for marginal hail sizes. McCarthy says this new criteria should cut down on a number of warnings and cut down on a number of programming interruptions that local broadcast stations are forced to make for severe thunderstorm warnings. When severe thunderstorm warnings are issued, the storms will have the potential to cause damage. That was filed by W1ISH via AR Newsline. Hams needed for May 3rd Bread Walk for Hunger in Boston. Organizers of the Ham Radio Support Group for this year's Project Bread Walk for Hunger in Boston, Massachusetts, are looking for volunteers. The date of the event is May 3rd, and this will be the 41st running of the event. Eric Horwitz, KA1NCF, the Amateur Radio Communications Coordinator for the event, says the hams are needed to provide communication support along the 20-mile walk. If you are interested in helping out this year, go to http://wfh.mmra.org and fill out the sign-up form. AR Newsline on Facebook. Amateur Radio Newsline is now on Facebook. After looking at all the social networking sites, it was decided that the format of Facebook is the best way for direct interaction with its listeners. If you are already on Facebook, you are invited to friend the Amateur Radio Newsline page. You will find it by searching the organizations, clubs, and societies area of Facebook. Of course, AR Newsline filed that piece. Hi, hi. One more news front tidbit, practice Morse code on 2 meter FM. If you live in the Kansas City area and want to practice CW, that's the Morse code, take your radio to the Kansas City 145.37 repeater for the Independence CW over FM Net. The Net meets at 1900 Central Standard Time every Monday night. Anyone with an interest in Morse and who owns a CW practice oscillator is more than welcome to participate. That was submitted by KC0WTS. I'll lead off this month in May 2009 with the Handy Hams. Of course, the Handy Ham system provides this recording for your listening pleasure, so I think it's only proper that we give them first-in-line consideration. Patrick Tice, WA0TDA, the director of the Courage Handy Ham system, titles his piece, "I'm a Good Driver and You're Not." There's an old saying that tells us every person with a driving license believes that they are a very good driver and that other drivers have a lot to learn. Isn't that the truth? We all like to think we are good at about everything that we do. Other people think of themselves in exactly the same way, because that is human nature. The problem is that we can't all be correct, can we? Even though I have been driving a car since I have been a sophomore in high school, those decades of driving experience don't necessarily mean that I drive better than everyone else. After all, I may have some bad driving habits that I have picked up over the years. I may not recognize my own bad habits because of my assumption that I am a good driver. All those people flashing their headlights and honking their horns at me just because I am driving on the wrong side of the road while talking on my cellular phone and playing the banjo don't know a good driver when they see one. Okay, that's a little extreme. But the same thing can happen in amateur radio. How many people have you heard on the air proclaiming that someone else is a poor operator, has done something wrong, doesn't know what they are doing, should never have gotten a license, and so on? Oddly enough, these same operators who complain so loudly oftentimes have rather poor operating habits themselves. You can be licensed for many years, even decades, and still not have a clue that your operating technique leaves a bit to be desired. One wise amateur radio operator once told me that there is a big difference between having 10 years of experience on the air and having 1 year of experience 10 times over. What he meant by that was that some people simply do the same thing over and over again, never venturing forth to learn new things or to really improve their operating techniques. Now, I'm not going to claim that I am a genius at self-realization, which is to say, really understanding myself and knowing for sure what I do correctly and realizing now where I need to make some improvements. But one thing I do know for sure is that as certainly as I am not the world's best driver, I am also not the world's best amateur radio operator, and just knowing that helps me keep an open mind to learning new things, especially things that will make me a better radio operator. It's still hard to improve on the amateur's code, which you can find on the ARRL website at www.arrl.org/acode.html. Thanks to the members of the Ham Radio Club, you will have an opportunity to learn how to be a better amateur radio operator. You can check into the regular Wednesday night Handy Ham Echo Link Net, and lucky you, the first Wednesday of each month, the theme of the net is one of learning and training. Although the primary focus is on how to be a good, even great, net control station, most of the same operating techniques that make a good net control will also apply to normal day-to-day amateur radio communications. Please join us and check in or simply listen in as you see fit. Here's a brief summary of the times. Wednesday evenings at 20:30 hours, USA Eastern Daylight Time. That's 8:30 p.m. 17:30 hours, USA Pacific Daylight Time, 5:30 p.m. GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, Thursday morning at 01:30 Zulu. Now where? 145.450 megahertz and 0BVE repeater. That's Minneapolis, St. Paul. Node number 89680. Echo Link Worldwide. IRLP node 9008. Vancouver, British Columbia Reflector. Wires, system number 1427. Everyone is welcome. You do not need to be a member, and the net is relaxed, friendly, and informal. It is only a training net on the first Wednesday of each month. The other Wednesdays are simply regular social net nights. You can check in each week, and if you feel brave enough, offer to take the net control position. If you make a mistake, so what? We are all learning to drive, so to speak. Better to learn in an informal setting with your friends than to make those mistakes on a traffic net in an emergency situation. Find out more about the non-profit Handy Ham System, whose mission is to help people with disabilities earn their amateur radio licenses and be great operators. On the Internet, http://handyham.org. Handyham spelled here is H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, handyham.org. That's the Courage Center Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN 55422. There is a toll-free number also, 1-866-426-3442. You can contact us by email, hamradio, all lowercase, hamradio, one word, at couragecenter.org. We thank Pat Tice, WA0TDA, for the update from the Handy Hams. Folks, every month, John B. Johnson, called W3BE, writes rules and regs, rules and regulations. This month it's titled The Rules Say by John. Question, what would you think of proposing a rule that would sanction me as a licensed amateur radio operator to permit non-FCC licensed persons such as my XYL, that's his wife, and my kids to use my station provided that I retain responsibility for any violations that they cause? The answer from John B. Johnson's W. 3BE O. Graham. Very risky. That could be totally inconsistent with the justification for the very allocation of our spectrum. To enable duly authorized persons interested in radio technique solely with a personal aim and without pecuniary interest to carry out self-training, intercommunications, and technical investigations. If that description doesn't fit your targeted family members and friends, their radio communications needs might be accommodated by one of the personal radio services, HF Citizen Band, UHF Family and General Mobile, and VHF Multi-Hughes. They would, moreover, have to put down their beloved cell phones. Another question. But don't we want more hams? W3BEO Graham is hoping that every person on a planet for whom our spectrum is allocated goes on to qualify for an amateur operator license and utilizes our spectrum for doing that for which it was allocated. One more question. Our weekly net is called by our club president's non-ham son using his father's call sign. Sometimes the father will also check in. When asked if he personally needs to identify the station, he says no. How can people listening know that the legitimate control operator is present if they don't identify? The answer again. Unless you can recognize the voices, listeners can only assume that the station is transmitting in compliance with Section 97.7. When transmitting, each amateur station must have a control operator. The control operator must be a person for whom an amateur operator, slant primary, station license grant appears on the ULS or is authorized for alien reciprocal operation. That is what the FCC does. Section 97.103 sub B says the station license must designate the station control operator. The FCC will presume that the station licensee is also the control operator unless documentation to the contrary is in the station records. Now, W3BEO Graham comments, seemingly, your club president does not appreciate the necessity for every control operator to prove his or her competence through examination. The fallacy with this refutation is that it bypasses our qualifying system. In fact, it undercuts the need for any operator license or examination and nudges our amateur service toward irrelevancy. John B. Johnson, W3BE, goes on with quite a few questions and answers, always very interested and always participating. We thank John very much for his long years of effort in the amateur community. And I'll close with a note of appreciation from the Quarter Century Wireless Association. Our RNR Super Ham of the Month is Ken McKee, M-C-K-E-E, call W3RFQ from our QCWA Chesapeake chapter number 20. Congratulations, Ken, for receiving the QCWA Presidential Section 97.1E Award for continuing and extending the amateur operator's unique ability to enhance international goodwill. And there's John with the smiling Ken McKay with a few friends in the background. Well, we're talking the May issue of World Radio Magazine online, and it isn't too far now for the month of June, and CPAC, S-C-A-P-A-C, the ARRL Northwest Division Ham Convention. The dates are June 5, 6, and 7, 2009. You're encouraged to attend the Northwest's largest ham convention. It's at the Seaside Slant Pacific Ham Convention, Seaside Convention Center, Seaside, Oregon. What does that have to do with Seaside, huh? There are going to be seminars, prizes, banquet, Paul Linham, DX Luncheon, YLRL Luncheon, dealer exhibits, VE testing, manufacturers, and 100-plus flea market tables. So if you happen to be traveling around the Pacific Northwest, certainly one of the most beautiful geographic areas of our great United States, try to swing by CPAC between June 5th, 6th, and 7th, 2009 in Seaside, Oregon. Going now to MCOM and You, an MRE lesson from a second grader. the author Jerry Wellman called W7SAR. When I respond to a public service event as a communications person, I try to anticipate what I might need and gather gear accordingly. Some items are obvious, like food and drink. For many years, I've tried to carry an MRE, that's meal, ready to eat, or two, and some containers of water. I have to admit, however, that I will often go hungry rather than eat my MRE. Why? They're expensive and sometimes not all that appealing. On a training event, I might stop by a fast food outlet on my way to the scene, and more than I want to admit, other times I don't grab the MRE or fast food, telling myself that I'll be okay. It's just a couple of hours. Getting a burger or not taking the basics is a wrong move on my part if I'm trying to teach myself preparedness. I might be unable to find a functioning food outlet during an actual emergency, or I could be delayed in getting home and might find myself pretty hungry. Which brings me back to my need to have available and bring appropriate gear for any event, training, or actuality. I have several bags that contain one, two, or more MREs and a bag of personal items such as soap, toothpaste, a towel, and a AA battery shaver. If I neglect to take them, I'm just being lazy. But if I want to use the gear I take, I find it inconvenient and costly to open the MRE package and just nibble on the dessert, or eat only one or two items in the MRE, then to go find the MRE store and replenish my supply. Well, I have been educated by my 8-year-old grandson, Noel Wellman, and I have a solution that I am comfortable recommending to you as well. A couple of weeks ago, I was asking all the normal grandpa questions such as, how's school? What are you learning? And are you getting good grades? Nolan was a wealth of information and carefully outlined his school experiences. Then he said, do you know what I like best about my school? I replied that I didn't and prodded him to tell me. The part I like best, he said, is lunch. And especially the Uncrustables. Priding myself in being somewhat knowledgeable in school matters, my wife is a fourth grade teacher, I had no idea what an Uncrustable was and to what purpose it was used. Nolan began to describe, in second grader detail, what an Uncrustable was. It sounded very interesting, in fact. It was so interesting that I did what any grandpa would do and took Nolan to a neighborhood store to purchase several boxes of Uncrustables. Nolan was delighted, and I was excited to find what I think will be an excellent grab-and-go food item. If you have already sampled these goodies, you know that they're made by Smucker's and are a frozen peanut butter and jelly sandwich, either grape or strawberry. They're called Uncrustables because they have no crust. It's like you took a sandwich and cut the crust off. Here's the deal. You get your box of Uncrustables and store them in your freezer. When you leave the house, you can grab several and just toss them in your gearbox. You don't nuke them in the microwave or heat them or do anything except wait for them to thaw. In about 30 minutes, you have a pretty tasty peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And we have a picture here of Nolan, N-O-L-A-N, Nolan Wellman. It states, Nolan has introduced a new emergency food to his grandpa. He's posing in the shack with a box of strawberry Uncrustables. Great photograph of young Nolan Wellman. I'll continue with Jerry's commentary. Last weekend, I was headed out the door to a training class. I made the effort to take appropriate gear, that's radio bag, food bag, etc., and I grabbed a grape and a strawberry Uncrustable. The box says they're good unfrozen for as many as 12 hours. So about 4 hours later, I'm headed home and munching on my thawed sandwich. Cost? About $1 for two. And I didn't need to open the MRE package, and I didn't need to find the MRE store. I still had 18 more Uncrustables in my freezer, and I don't tell my grandkids they're there, or I'd have none left. My recommendation? If you're not allergic to peanut butter and jelly, it's worth consideration for including in your list of things to grab when you go. Now, for my listener, Jerry Wilmer goes on to talk about fixing things and soldering things, but we'll leave that for another time. We thank Jerry Wellman, who offers best wishes from Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm going now to the Youth Forum Brown Bag Lunch Visit. Oh, we're still talking about food. We take it the way it lies, folks. The author here is Carol with an E, Perry. The reason I say Carol with an E, because I have a wife named Carol with an E, and she's very particular about making sure that people spell her name correctly, C-A-R-O-L-E. So that's it, Carol Perry, WB2-MGP. I recently received an invitation to do a ham radio demonstration at a local elementary school on Staten Island, New York. Public School 69 has created a wonderful program called Brown Bag Lunch Visits. Several students are chosen to bring their lunch and listen to an interesting guest speaker from their community. The children have recently heard presenters who are bakers, electricians, naval officers, magicians, and one lady who demonstrated calligraphy, and another who taught them simple knitting. Then it was my turn. It was my second time there as a presenter, so I knew what visual aids would work in that particular setting. This time I would be speaking to second graders, fourth graders, and fifth graders in separate sessions. Having been retired from teaching now for almost 5 years, I was really excited to work with the kids again. I decided, because of the big age range, to pick a topic that all the children always enjoy. The role that ham radio has in my classes making astronaut contacts. I had a huge chart of the space suit with all the names of all the many parts drawn in. It always amazes me how so many children are under the misconception that the astronauts wear their space suits on board the shuttle. To clear up many of the mysteries and questions about life on board the space shuttle, I showed them a video that depicts eating, sleeping arrangements, doing exercise, and just having fun in microgravity. We, of course, discussed the role of communications with a shuttle that is more than 200 miles above Earth. At this point, I showed them the DVD of my ham radio classes contacting the Challenger in 1985. Via slow-scan TV equipment set up in our school auditorium with the help of the local ham radio clubs. You could feel the excitement in the air with all three of the groups. They had so many questions for me. It was terrific. During the discussions about radio communications, I took out my little code keys that I had custom made for me when I was teaching. It's actually a small code practice oscillator in a little earring box that has its own volume and tone adjustments. Before I left that day, all the students were sending SOS. The fun and enthusiasm spilled out of the room as other teachers came to the door to watch what we were doing. I left the kids with a ham radio search a word puzzle. The first two to complete it correctly were each given a package of astronaut ice cream. What a great day. As much as I love doing these demos for young groups, my main goal is to get a radio program started in as many schools as possible. In my new role of heading up the Radio Club of America's Education Committee, I am constantly on the lookout for schools across the country with licensed hams who would like to start a radio program, but don't know how to begin. Please, please contact me. Through the many wonderful resources of the Radio Club of America, we can help make it happen by providing all kinds of resources, both technical and otherwise. The purpose of going into schools and doing these kinds of demos is an enlightening, fun experience for all the children who are exposed to it. Don't reinvent the wheel. Contact me for more tips on how to inspire youngsters to get involved with technical pursuits. Also, please share with me any successful experiences you or your group has had with presentations at schools. I know there's a wealth of valuable resources out there amongst devoted ham operators. Let's spread it around for the next generation. That concludes the piece in this month's May 2009 World Radio Online presentation titled Brown Bag Lunch Visit by Carol with an E, Perry. Call WB2MGP, Youth Forum. Well, we'll move now to FM, VHF, and repeaters, titled Looking West. A welcome to Laura L. Smith and the VHF Connection. The author is Bill Pasternak, call WA6ITF. Perhaps the words of QRZ.com editor Terry Graves, call K7FE, say it best, quoting, "There's a new sheriff in town. The FCC has appointed Laura Smith to take Riley Hollingsworth's former position in enforcement. The FCC has been slow to fill a position, and for a while we wondered if Riley's successor would ever be named. It looks like they were waiting for the right person. Now that Laura is on the job, let's give her our full support." Close quote. Laura Smith is not a licensed radio amateur. Her background is communications law. She is a 1990 graduate of the Pepperdine University School of Law and began her legal career with the FCC, working in the Mass Media Bureau and Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. She also served as Deputy Division Chief of the Public Safety and Private Wireless Division. She is currently licensed to practice law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. In 1998, Smith departed FCC service to become Executive Director of Governmental Affairs for the Industrial Telecommunications Association. In 2001, she was named the organization's President and Chief Executive Officer. She has also served as counsel with the Maryland law firm of Shulman Rogers, where she dealt primarily with telecommunications issues. Laura Smith has also served as an industry consultant and has written columns for a variety of trade publications, including Mobile Radio Technology Magazine and the Private Wireless Magazine. Her appointment has been very welcome news to the nation's ham radio community, which in recent months has seen a noticeable increase in overt rules violations. As Terry Graves stated on QRZ.com, quoting again, "Amateur radio has always been somewhat self-policed, but when peer pressure is not enough to maintain civility, then a stronger hand is needed. The FCC has the muscle to demand compliance of the few wavered operators." Close quote. We will add our view that the appointment of Laura Smith as our new sheriff should make it clear to those who break the Part 97 amateur service rules that the FCC intends to continue to work with the ham radio community to get regulatory violators to reform or, if necessary, take them off the air. If you have an enforcement issue, you may be reached by email at lowercase laura.smith@fcc.gov. So that's laura.smith@fcc.gov. Subsection titled here, History, Enforcement Before Riley Hollingsworth and Laura Smith. The concept of self-policing is just that. It is a concept that relies on the majority to control the activities of the minority of operators who violate the FCC Part 97 rules. In the early days of the hobby, it worked well, primarily because just about everyone was fearful of receiving a notice from the FCC monitoring station that he or she had violated a rule. In the early days, most of these notices were not having a signal that meant the standards of the area, such as key clicks on CW or splatter on a full carrier AM signal. This was quite effective until the late 1960s, when some of those in violation began fighting back through court challenges and litigation. Some of this litigation involved the person charged with one or more violations hiring an attorney to file a civil action against those who leveled the charges against them. These suits were based on the plaintiff's belief that those complaining to the FCC were in essence uttering libelous and slanderous accusations, defamation of character, and the like. And incredibly, they were winning those cases. One of the earliest litigations of this type that I know of involved the old West Cars Traffic Net. The civil court decision in that case was like a stop sign to hams nationwide. Few were willing to complain to the government about what they perceived to be a rules violation if it might lead to the person whom they were accusing filing litigation against them and winding up before a judge and jury. Self-policing had come to a screeching halt. In the 1970s, the world of FM and repeaters caught the imagination of the world's ham radio community. Starting with a single success in the late 1950s by the late Art Gentry called W6MEP, repeater growth took off around the nation and the globe. The big spurt began about 1965 and did not stop until 2005. That's a solid 40 years of more and more repeaters activated on the air with few going away. The majority of the growth was on 2 meters, with 70 centimeters coming in a close second. Even 10 meters, traditionally considered a high-frequency band, began seeing a mounting number of in-band relay devices at its high end. As you might expect, in most cities, 1 or 2 repeaters became the general meeting ground for the local ham community. In the 1960s, in New York City, it was the WA2SUR, 146.13 slant 146.73, repeater located at the WXTV transmitter site in Lower Manhattan, and the W2KEC machine, 146.40 slant 147.0 on the Chrysler Building in Midtown. When I moved to Los Angeles, I quickly found that the Mount Wilson WA6TDD 146.40 slant 147.435 machine was the place to be if you wanted to make new friends and meet new people. When I began writing Looking West for the late 73 magazine, I learned that this same paradigm of an in-repeater seemed to hold true in every major city around the world. The success of the idea of an in-repeater as a central meeting spot was a great one, but it had one pitfall. It was the perfect spot for hams with their own agendas to set up shop, hog the use of a repeater, and preach their own cause du jour. Repeaters, by their very design, allowed them to talk for a great distance. While repeaters were supposed to be from mobile to mobile or mobile to base communications, factions grew up in some cities and towns with home or base stations that used high-power amplifiers and directional antennas to capture the repeater's input. These operators would also use a second receiver and antenna to monitor the repeater's output to know if or when they timed out so that they could briefly drop their signal, reset the repeater's timeout feature, and continue their diatribes. There were also those who are just plain vicious. Their enjoyment in life came from inflicting misery on their fellow radio amateurs by jamming transmissions, transmitting obscenities, or anything else that they could think of to cause disruption. By the late part of the 1970s, some of these goofballs actually teamed up to form what can best be described as loose-knit jamming groups, names like Underground Radio in Los Angeles, the Jam Masters in the Northeast, and Jamming International, which seemed to have its roots in Europe, though nobody was ever certain, came to the attention of the ham radio public. Most, though not all, of the folks involved in this on-the-air malevolent behavior used the excuse that they were, paraphrased, in a war to free repeater users from the tyranny of oppressive repeater owners, an oppressive ARRL and or an oppressive FCC. Now, I know for some of you new to the hobby, a lot of this may be a bit hard to believe. but it was well documented in the ham radio news media and magazines of the time. If you want to learn more about the strife afflicting many repeaters in the latter 1970s through the early 1990s, all you need to do is find a library that has back issues of the old HR report or Westlink report, ham radio newsletters, or the now-defunct 73 magazine. It is all there, exactly as it happened. History has shown that when a champion or hero is needed by society, one seems to appear out of nowhere. You know, that old description of a knight in shining armor riding a white horse? In the case of malicious interference, there was no shining armor nor horse of any color involved. Our champion came to the ham radio public's attention in 1978 driving a brown Cadillac with a Kenwood 2-meter radio under the dash and a legal briefcase in a trunk. He was Joe Mertler, that's spelled M-E-R-D-L-E-R, Mertler, N-6-A-H-U, an attorney from North Hollywood, California. From 1978 almost to his death more than a decade ago, Joe was a crusader against rules violators. Joe Mertler was directly responsible for more than half a dozen folks losing their licenses. He was heavily involved in forcing the FCC to act against organized repeater jamming in the Southwest. In fact, he became such a high-profile enemy of the nation's 1980s ham radio counterculture and so successful in leading enforcement efforts that he made national headlines when several crosses were burned on his front lawn. While this crime was never solved, it was believed to have been a warning from the underground radio group for him to back off. But Joe Mertler was one lawyer who would not be bullied. Possibly because of this incident, N6AHU, went full steam ahead and spent the next decade working with the FCC, the ARRL, and the local Los Angeles ham community. This directly led to the previously noted license cancellations and revocations. Joe was also an advisor to several groups in other parts of the nation facing similar problems, including a famed Alabama repeater jamming prosecution in the late 1980s. For his efforts in combating malicious interference, Joe Mertler, N6AHU, was named recipient of the 1980 Dayton Hamvention Special Achievement Award. After Mertler's passing, there was little amateur radio enforcement for about 4 years, with one exception, the ongoing action against the late Richard Burton, ex-WB6JAC. Burton was a former ham who had his license pulled in the 1970s but refused to go off the air. And it was only due to the diligence of now-retired FCC Los Angeles FCC EIC Larry Guy that Burton kept going back on trial, being convicted and sent off to jail. By the late 1990s, the situation on HF, single sideband, and VHF repeaters had deteriorated to the point where, in some places, it was impossible to get on a repeater or a net without getting jammed or harassed. More and more hams were reticent to turn on their gear and demonstrated for fear that a CQ would be answered by a diatribe of four-letter words from an unidentified operator. Ham radio was just not very pleasant back then. That's when the ARRL started to pressure the FCC to take some definitive action against the more egregious violators. The FCC did one better by assigning Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, as a special counsel to deal with amateur radio enforcement issues. In short order, he eliminated the most high-profile offenders. Among other things, he forced an end to a so-called ham radio call-in talk show on 20 and 75 meters, which for several years was a true bone of contention in our ham radio community. And if you go to the bands at 144 megahertz and above, the level of malicious interference to repeater operations has dropped immensely from where it was just a decade ago. Yes, today the number of hams that use repeaters has also dropped, but that's cyclical and will rise again with the next influx of new operators. Being a news writer, I have been on the FCC's press release list since the late 1970s. As such, I automatically began receiving e-copies of every action in Part 97 matters as soon as Riley Hollingsworth began his cleanup effort. Many of you may not be aware of that. The number of matters in amateur radio enforcement went into the hundreds. Yes, you've heard about the high-profile cases, but these were really a small number of the overall actions Hollingsworth's office was involved in. And there are the hundreds of complaints that never even resulted in a follow-up letter to an offender. Many of those were solved in a simple telephone conversation with Hollingsworth. Now regarding the future, what will the enforcement policy of the FCC be under the aegis of Laura Smith? No matter what direction she takes, we in the ham radio community can only be better off for it. As it was in the era of FCC rules enforcer Riley Hollingsworth, K4CDH, the only ones who will be complaining will be those who get caught breaking the Part 97 rules and who feel that they must now make a lot of noise in order to save face with their peers. The fact is that the only ones they will be fooling will be themselves, and it could be a very costly joke. Well, folks, that completes Bill Pasternak's article, Looking West, a Welcome to Laura L. Smith and the VHF Connection. As most all of you know, when I read any of the magazines, be it CQ or World Radio here, or QSD, I usually compact some of the lengthy articles because they simply do take a lot of our 60 minutes worth of recorded time. But I am so pleased with Bill Pasternak's efforts over the long term here, as well as many other good folks who present material for publication, that I purposely let this run to the very end because I think, I hope you think as well, that what he just wrote and I just read was really right on target, and I commend him again very much. Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. Let's see what's in the Hamfest category for now. That's Hamfests and special events. In the month of May, they're listing three, beginning in Indiana. The special call sign W9M, Whiskey 9 Mike, special event station, 9 May 2009 from 1300 to 0100 UTC, commemorating the 25th anniversary of the Mid-State Amateur Radio Club, Franklin, Indiana. Various frequencies. They will QSL. State of Michigan, 47th Annual Cadillac Swap, Saturday, sponsored by the Wixhexy Amateur Radio Club. Saturday, May 2 at Cadillac Junior High School, 500 Chestnut Street, Cadillac, Michigan. The great state of Nevada, MCOM West Slant Pacificon, the 09, May 1, 2, and 3 at Circus Hotel and Casino in Reno, Nevada, up in the beautiful mountains. Month of June, California, special event station N6R, November 6, Romeo, special event commemorating the lives of President and Mrs. Ronald Reagan. From the grounds of the President Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum, Simi Valley, California, begins 1800 Zulu, 26 June, through 1900 Zulu, 28 June, 2009. They'll be represented in all the different bands and other bands as well, including 3.5, 50, 144, 440, megahertz, and 10 gigahertz. It's hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum and sponsored by Ventura County Amateur Radio Society, the Simi Valley ARC, and Ventura County ARC, VCARC, QSL, with the same address stamped envelope, too. Ventura County Amateur Radio Society, care of Peter Hines, H-E-I-N-S, 1559-1559 Norwich Avenue, Thousand Oaks, California, 91360. You can check that out at www.vcars.org. State of New York, the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club Hamfest will be held at the New York Hall of Science parking lot in Flushing Meadows, Corona Park. Now, folks, I must be honest with you. I think they really, just by mistake, left out the actual date in the month of June, because I've looked at it three times now. I don't see what date. Interestingly enough, the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club is being ousted. You might recall I just made a commentary about that at the beginning of this recording. So if you're in that general New York area, you really should try to give them a call and see what's going on. In fact, it says here, more information, you could call at night only. Stephen Greenbaum, Steve's call is WB2KDG. His phone number is area 718-898-5599. Or you can email him at WB2KDG@ARRL.net. The website there is www.hosarc.org. They probably have the date on that, for that matter. That's the website again is www.hosarc.org. State of Tennessee, Knoxville Hamfest and Electronics Exposition and ARRL Tennessee State Convention, June 13, Kerbella Temple, Knoxville, Tennessee. You know, I'm running out of time, but I don't want to ignore the YLs, the young ladies. They are out there. Here's a piece by Cheryl Muir, M-U-H-R, call N-C-O-W-B-V. I'm happy to report that the YLs are definitely getting on the air. How do I know this? Well, from first-hand experience, I am talking to them. This year, I decided to work on a few of my YL awards. The good news is that there are a lot of YL awards and certificates available, including many that OM, old men, can earn as well. That's male operators, folks. Many countries, including the United States, Canada, and Japan, have YL awards. The awards that I am concentrating on this year are, point, the YL Century Club, YLCC, work 100 different YLs. Point, the YL-WAS, because I am so close to completing it. That's YL work to all states. Point, the YL Friendship Award. That speaks for itself. Some of these aren't difficult. Just get on the air and try to work YLs. Okay, so maybe it isn't that easy. When I get on the call for YLs, many OMs don't realize what I am doing. I have to specify that I am looking for other ladies and not the prefix YL. That leads me back to the YLs being on the air. First, I worked a few in January. Some YLs were on from the YLISSBQ sub-party, and some I just found calling CQ. Usually there was a big pile-up as well. Second, in February, I got on and called CQ YLCQ ladies. As I mentioned earlier, I had to differentiate what I was doing. My call for YLs resulted in a massive pile-up. Whoa-wee! It's always fun to run a pile-up. The kicker was that they were mostly OM gentlemen, but some DX as well. A few people weren't too thrilled at the rate I was working stations and asked why I don't stop and rag chew. I do rag chew sometimes, but in this case it was a very big pileup. I wanted to talk to more people and was hunting for YL contacts. This is one area that we have always had issues with in the hobby. You have to remember that just because you like contesting doesn't mean everyone does, too. Those who don't contest get mad during contest weekends. Rag chewers get mad at short QSOs, and people who like short QSOs get mad at rag chewers. We need to respect that many of us have a different style of operating and that we don't always agree. Well, Cheryl Muir goes on about her adventures with YLs and OMs and so forth. But in conclusion, she comments, I hope to be reporting on the all-YLD expedition to VP8, the Falklands, this issue. But the information was delayed. Don't worry. I'm still in contact with members of the trip and we'll get you the information soon. Send news. I need to hear from you. Where are you going? What are you doing? And if you are a Dayton, stop by and see me at the Young Ladies Radio League, YLRL Table, 73 Cheryl and 0 WBV. Well, folks, I've really run out of time. I hate it because there were several other really fine pieces, especially the QCWA, Quarter Century Wireless Association piece by Alan Pickering. He titled it, After Kilroy Comes the QCWA. You'll just have to look it up yourself and have someone read it to you offline. Hi. This brings me to the conclusion of the digest reading of World Radio Magazine for May 2009 here on the Courage Handyham system. CQ is published by Rich Mawson, called W2VU. CQ Communications, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The recording is a production of the Courage Handyham system, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. We have a great website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH is right down here in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, near Buzzards Bay on the way to Cape Cod. Wave at exit 11 on 195 as you go by. 73.